The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Well, this week I'm coming to you live from Oakland, California. This week we're going to be talking about domestic marijuana policy and we're going to be looking at the international war on drugs. First, though, I want to tell you that I was extremely honored this weekend. A conference went on down in Oakland, California. There was a picket, a union strike against the hotel where that conference was being held, so I did not attend that conference. I don't cross picket lines. No one ever should, period. There was a social event that was planned alongside the conference. Because of the strike, the social event was moved to another location. Very kindly, Ricardo Baca from The Cannabist allowed the use of his space and a party he was already planning to have this event. A handful of us, including Wayne Justman, Mickey Norris, and Chris Conrad, and the late Joanna McKee, and a few others of us, were honored at this event. It was very kind. The amazing efforts of Ophelia Chong from Stockpot Images made it all happen. I am exceptionally, exceptionally honored to be included among those people, and I am very grateful to Ophelia from Stockpot Images, and also to the folks at that conference for allowing the event to be taken off-site to a place where, well, frankly, where people like me and the rest of the people being honored would be able to attend. It's a great time, it's great people, and again, it was just an honor to be up alongside all those people. I got some sound. Wasn't exactly the best sound system. Here.
Thank you, Ricardo. Thank you so much for letting us bring this here from the Marriott, because there's a really important reason why we're here, because we respected the picket line. We understand what everyone has to do for a living. But however, the real reason why we have these people here is because they built this foundation that you are all standing on. These are just a few. I cannot do thousands. I wish I could. But they built this foundation that this future mansions would be built on. And I want the people who are going to build those mansions to realize that they're not sitting on sand, they're sitting on concrete that these people have done decades of work for. And we don't have time for everyone to hear their stories, but I would like just to introduce them. And if you could, then you can find them out later and meet them.
That's all you're getting. That was about as good as that's about as good a sound as I got. So let's just go on with the show, shall we? First up, marijuana in the United States.
I am Adam Smith. I am the founder and executive director of the Craft Cannabis Alliance.
Adam, we're here at the International Cannabis Business Conference. You just spoke a few moments ago. Now, you're working with Floyd Przanski about this export thing. Tell me about this idea.
So Oregon, as is well known, at least here in the industry, has a glut of product. And the reason is that when we legalized the industry here in Oregon, we legalized the industry we had. And the industry we had was locally based and widespread. But the industry we had was an export industry. It was a medical industry, for sure, but we've been exporting product out of Oregon for generations. And so when the state said to folks, go legal, they were inviting the growers that existed here, which was important, into the industry. We made licensing cheap and plentiful, and that was a great instinct, because we didn't bring in people to supplant the industry that was here. We wanted to lift it up. On the back end of that is we now have way more cannabis than our intrepid population can get through inside of a year, and there's a market for it all over the country, and so we need to get it out of the state before those wonderful local growers get ground into fine dust and pushed out of business. We're heading in a direction here where It's in 3 or 4 years, if we don't open up new markets, the local industry will have been driven either out of business or bought out for pennies by large out-of-state and international companies that have come here and are buying up farms and buying up retail and buying up brands. And we're not saying they don't belong here. We're just saying that if we lose ownership, local ownership of this industry, it'll be a giant economic problem for the state. We're looking at hundreds of millions of dollars right now in local capital that is at imminent risk of being wiped out. And it's not, you know, Intel's local capital or Nike's local capital. It's thousands of people who are, have gone all in to be part of this industry. Their money, their friends and family's money, small investors. And so export, opening up markets for our product is the next step. And so the first thing we need to do here in Oregon is we need a bill. We're gonna be pushing a bill with Senator Prezansky's help in the 2019 session that will make it legal under state law for the executive branch through OLCC to approve out-of-state transfers. Right now, it is illegal under state law to do so. So even if cannabis became legal federally, it would be illegal for us to send it out of the state. So that is the first step, and we need to use the campaign for that bill to raise the profile of this issue, have a national conversation about the future of cannabis economics. And again, you know, as we were talking before we came on the air, we have never made advances in cannabis policy waiting for the federal government to give us permission to do something, right? We would still be waiting for the first medical sales if that was the case 20 years later. So what we need to do is we need to find our partners, make this an issue that can't be avoided by the federal government, and then force their hand to make a decision. Are they going to enforce federal law against states that want to have, you know, licensed, regulated trade? The option is not to not have export. The option is to have export as we do now, which is unlicensed, unregulated, not under the control of anyone, and not bringing revenues into the state.
Because the skeptics, of course, would point out, well, the federal government doesn't allow interstate transfer. And as we were saying, the federal government also doesn't really allow cultivation or possession of marijuana. They certainly don't allow stores like the one around the corner from my apartment or any of the other ones along McLaughlin. There are about half a dozen or so within a mile of my apartment. I live in a great part of the state. What can I say? So really all you're doing is trying to get the state started along the process.
Right. The first step will allow the governor the authority, or the OLCC the authority, to approve interstate transfer when it's appropriate to do so. And so at the very worst, we want to be ready the moment the federal government allows it to happen. But almost more likely, perhaps, we want to force the issue to the federal government. We want to get to the edge of the state's border and look up at the federal government and wait for them to blink. And force their hand, again, because waiting for permission has never been a profitable strategy in cannabis.
So now, how do people find more information about the Craft Cannabis Alliance? How can people keep up with the stuff with the work you're doing?
So for the export work, onefixcannabis.org, and that's O-N-E-F-I-X, and one stands for Oregon Needs Export. So it's one fix, many problems, oversupply, financial crisis, diversion into the illicit market, many problems. There's one fix: allow us markets to sell our products into.
I guess some skeptics would say that part of the problem is you've got the people who want to see those prohibition era profits, and of course part of that's driven by the investors who piled in here and bought out companies, and so if we opened up an export market, if that were available, I suppose that would be one more way of getting those, of getting, I mean.
Right, the large companies that have come into Oregon and bought up farms and retails, they are not here because they think they're going to get rich selling cannabis to Oregonians. There's a pretty good argument to be made that the last profitable dollar has already been made selling cannabis to Oregonians. That's a little bit hyperbole, but but the large companies are here because when the walls do come down, they want to own the Oregon brand nationally and globally. The Oregon cannabis brand is extremely valuable. It's very much like our wine brand and our beer and our distilling and our food. The Oregon brand is about authenticity. It's about people with their hands in the dirt making something they love as well as they possibly can for themselves and their friends and to share with other people who love it. And that is what makes our, you know, our other products valuable in outside markets, and cannabis is no different. But the shame of it is that if it takes 4 or 5 years for us to get to export, the Oregon brand will be owned by these, you know, a dozen or 15 or 16 large out-of-state companies, and we will have lost the authenticity that that brand is born out of. And so we need to open up the borders and let product out while there still is a local industry here, an artisan industry here that is growing and producing the best cannabis products in the world.
Out of state, out of country, I've already run into at least one person with an investment fund based up in Canada.
Yep.
And frankly, God knows where that the money in their fund is coming from.
Right.
You know, which other countries, which other investors. And even I have to admit, the idea of opening up the export market is, that's a little ways down the road. But you got to start down that road sometime or other.
Our goal is to get to export by the end of 2020. And we think that that's possible. And the first step is to pass this bill in the 2019 Oregon legislative session. And that will be an announcement that Oregon is ready and waiting to be open for business. And that, we are hoping, will help facilitate a national conversation about the obvious economics that are coming in the cannabis industry. A couple of months ago, New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, famously, formerly an opponent of cannabis, has done a 180-degree turn. And he said a couple of months ago, the question is not whether New York State should or will legalize cannabis. The question is how it will legalize cannabis. And right now, under the current regime, the only way for New York to legalize cannabis for recreational use would be for them to create from scratch a production industry about 4 to 5 times the size of Oregon's current production industry. That's probably not economically a very smart way for them to legalize cannabis. If you're gonna put billions of dollars into production in New York and then put billions of dollars into a similar production industry next door in New Jersey that is also looking to legalize, you need to start looking and see, is that going to be cost competitive and competitive with West Coast cannabis? Because ultimately, the wall will come down and West Coast cannabis will come east. The protection that states have is a historical quirk, and it will be gone as soon as, you know, at the very latest, as soon as federal prohibition ends. So states like New York and New Jersey, it's one thing to say you can get a license there, but to do that without also saying that we are going to bring product in from out of state is short-sighted. It will take them years and years to build a production industry large enough to serve a state like New York with 20 million people. The quality will not immediately be there. And so rather than, you know, pretend to investors that they are going to have, you know, clear sailing and a protectionist regime forever, they need to understand that anything that gets built in those states is going to need to be competitive with the West Coast, and you ought to go into it with eyes open and go into it saying that our legalization assumes that we are going to be able to import product. And once we have the states ready to import and the states ready to export, again, then we are where we always end up in cannabis policy, ready to take the next step, looking at the federal government, whether they go along, you know, or not.
All right. Adam, again, speaking with Adam Smith, Craft Cannabis Alliance.
Craft Cannabis Alliance and One Fix Cannabis.
One Fix Cannabis. So onefixcannabis.com?
.org.
.org. Onefixcannabis.org.
Right. And sign on to the letter. If you are in the industry, sign on to the letter. We are very soon going to have a more national letter. The one that's up there is to the Oregon legislators. But we are building a national campaign, because as much as we need to get Oregon cannabis out of the state, there are millions of people all over the country that would love to be able to access Oregon cannabis in their home state when it's legal.
Fantastic. Adam, good luck with it. And thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. Enjoy the conference.
Oh, yeah. You too.
That was my interview with Adam Smith. We met up at the International Cannabis Business Conference in Portland, Oregon, back in September. You are listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, let's look at international drug war. The Commission on Narcotic Drugs held one of its intersessional meetings at the end of September. A number of different delegations presented, a number of different representatives of the UN agencies, and a few people from civil society also spoke. We're going to hear a couple of the national delegations. First up, from Switzerland.
In 2015, the international community adopted the SDGs. Switzerland and we all thereby committed to achieving a better and more sustainable future for all. These goals help us to address the global challenges we are facing today. One of them is the world drug problem. Figures from the most recent World Drug report show that we need to address key causes, but also effects and unintended consequences. Figures from the World Drug Report show also that lots of gaps remain. We need data to learn more about these gaps. We need to know what drug policies are effective and efficient, and which one are not. This will help us maintain what we've reached so far and find new strategies to address these challenges. The SDGs are interconnected. Therefore, solutions to these challenges must be interconnected as well. In Switzerland, we have realized that drug policies have a stronger impact when we take into account the interlinkages between the SDGs. Let me illustrate the power of interlinkages with the example of SDG 3. SDG 3 aims at ensuring healthy life and the promotion of well-being for all at all stages. For all includes also drug users. They too, they have health needs. In this respect, Switzerland promotes and supports the implementation of the harm reduction packages of interventions as set out in the joint WHO, UNODC and UNAIDS technical guide that has presented here, I believe, 2 days ago. Ending the HIV epidemic contributes without a doubt to achievement of the SDGs goals. In addition, drug consumption rooms are part of the comprehensive Swiss approach to address the consequences of problematic substance use. Such interventions are key policy tools to mitigate some of the most devastating consequences of drug abuse, such as ODs, but also to support public safety and security. The UNGAS outcome document makes operation recommendations in 7 areas. Today, 2 years after its adoptions, we would like to reiterate Switzerland's support to these recommendations and their implementation. In addition, member states recognized that ensuring future drug policies operation within the SDGs is crucial. We committed with the SDGs to leave no one behind when we formulate and we implement drug policies as well. Let us not forget that. To achieve this, we recall the need for interagency cooperation as well as with member states and with civil society. Thank you.
That was the Swiss delegate speaking at the Commission on Narcotic Drugs intersessional meeting that was held in Vienna, Austria at the end of September. Those CND meetings are only webcast live. You can find out about them. You can find out about when they're being broadcast by going to unodc.org and looking for the Commission on Narcotic Drugs for their meetings and then checking on the intersessional and the upcoming high-level ministerial segment, which occurs in March every year. These are only webcast live. To be able to follow them, you must either watch and listen to the webcast live or become part of an NGO and attend in Vienna, or you can hear parts of the proceedings on this show, Century of Lies, because I will stay up overnight and record these things as much as I can. You can also follow the proceedings at cndblog.org. That's a project of the International Drug Policy Consortium. It is a fantastic resource. So let's hear some more from that Commission on Narcotic Drugs meeting, shall we? The delegate from Uruguay had a lot of great things to say. The simultaneous interpretation is provided by the United Nations.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for this meeting. And indeed, we commend everyone for having organized and designed this meeting. My fear was that we wouldn't be able to reach a successful conclusion to our debate, but after the excellent presentation given by Dr. Guerra and the very interesting responses given to the highly interesting questions put by colleagues, I'm fully convinced that if we're able to keep this level going for the upcoming sessions over the next few days, then undoubtedly we'll be making serious progress when it comes to our general manner of addressing drugs policies and the drug problem. Madam Chair, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to comply with your suggestion of simply abiding by what Dr. Guerra said, because first of all, I want to thank all of the colleagues who put their questions, but also I want to thank the representative of the United States, my friend seated next to me, for her statement and for her presentation too of what occurred yesterday in the US. I think it's very important, because things that happen in the US and in the UN in the US are not of minor importance. I'm talking about the statement made regarding the waging of a second war on drugs by the President of the United States and the President of Colombia. Now, of course, these are unilateral statements that are being made, bilateral perhaps by countries, but they're not multilateral. And as we all know here in the United Nations and in UNGAS and in any UN meeting, or in UNODC, or in the CND, of course, because we are the body of the CND, no such unilateral statements have ever been made. If they were ever made, there was perhaps some 47 years ago by President Nixon, who waged the first war on drugs. Now, I believe we all understand that that has been ended. That war was ended in 2016. It was ended once and for all at UNGAS of 2016. The war on drugs, as we had understood it, ended because we had lost that war, because the war on drugs was a war that we lost, as everyone admitted, as everyone said, and as was said yesterday by the President of the United States. If I understand correctly, he said that between 2000 and 2016, there was an increase in drug consumption, use, trafficking, by some 60%. Now, if that isn't tantamount to losing a war, well then please, what exactly is losing a war? If we've spent the past 15, 16 years, and that's the period that was covered here, not prior decades, if we've spent the last 15 years, well, what's the point then of a war on drugs? What could be the possible objective of a war on drugs? What would be the purpose of waging a second war on drugs? Now, we all know that this is not the position adopted by the CND. We also understand that this is not the position held multilaterally. This is a unilateral position. But the two presidents who launched that initiative and who have sought to wage that second war on drugs are the President of the United States and the President of Colombia, which is the country that over the past 40 years have suffered the highest level of deaths, murders, assassinations, and damage overall, let's say, as the fallout of a war on drugs, similar perhaps only to Mexico or perhaps to Afghanistan following the US invasion. So, Colombia, of course, serves as a point of reference and calling for the global eradication of drugs, the global eradication of plantations. Well, distinguished colleagues, esteemed colleagues, Madam Chair, it's a movie that we've all had to sit through once before. We've all seen this one. We all know how it turns out. Nixon launched that first war. And the outcome, 45 years ago or so, once again, led to resounding failure. We lost the war on drugs. Now, it's been said that Einstein said, as we all know, it's always worth quoting Einstein after all, because everyone's aware of Einstein, that if you keep applying the same recipes over and over again, of course you're going to see the same results. And therefore it's deeply worrying that while we are here participating in a meeting that I consider to be progressive in nature, groundbreaking, opening up new perspectives, focusing on public health, human rights in the public health sphere, where we see these alternative solutions being posited, prevention across the board. On the other hand, it's still the same old language of war on drugs, Madam Chair. Now, these are not compatible. Can we have a drugs-free world? without drug plantations as part of an ongoing war which has proven to be extremely harmful to life on the planet and which has not had an impact. We can't keep following that path. We're not going to do that. Last year, let's say 100 kilos were seized. Let's say that this year 150 kilos were seized. It's not about the number of kilos that were seized. It's about the amounts that are not being seized. Perhaps from 1,000 up to 1,500 the next year. So progress in terms of the war of drugs is unmarked. There are ongoing cases of overdosage. That doesn't change. It's worrying, Madam Chair, to see unilateralism coming to the fore in this matter. Statements are made by all parties, also at this meeting that we are attending, that the scope for resolution of this matter is here in the CND, and we are fully committed to that, and I believe that everybody here is fully committed to that. But in reality, that's not how it works. It's being resolved in an assembly by one president, President Trump, who declares a war on drugs. I don't think we can afford to sit here and behave as if nothing had happened. And I'm very grateful to our colleague from the US for having raised the matter. And I'm simply stating this now in order to put a simple question to you, because after all, this is the time for questions, not for statements. I do have a question, but not just one question. Not just one question for Mr. Garrett, for Dr. Garrett, but rather for all the panelists. And here's the question. Do you think that if we embark on a second war on drugs, as the President of the United States and as the President of Colombia called for yesterday, do you think we're going to see different results if we apply the same mechanisms? And if we again wage a war on eradicating drugs worldwide, are we going to see the same results? Or are we more likely to see more deaths, more corruption, more drugs, more money laundering? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Gracias, Uruguay.
Thank you very much, Uruguay. Dr. Garr.
I think that the question was for all. But
I'll go with all.
I don't renounce to say one word only. I think that the language, the war on drugs, were never adopted as a language by UNODC or by the CND, fortunately. The language war on drugs is not belonging to our language. Also because it is, we have always the doubt on the side of health that the war is done not against the drug trafficker, but against our patient, people affected by a drug use disorder. So for this reason, we don't like this word, war on drug. On the other side, let me say that personally, I like very much the statement, the sentence, a society free of drug abuse. Free of drug abuse, not free of drugs. That means an aspirational sentence, no? We say zero AIDS within 2030. We say zero poverty. We can dream also to have a society at zero of drug abuse in the future, for our future generation. This is also a message that we send to the new generation. Clearly, no one is so childish and so unrealistic, no, to understand that this can be done quickly. Abolishing the abuse of drugs from the face of the world. But I think that to sign the direction, to indicate the direction, is important to maintain this kind of approach. That is not a war. As I explained, it is a very complex problem because until the demand is not going down, supply will not go down. So we are today at the center stage of the scene of the framework where we design the drug policy, because until the request for demand for using drugs is not reduced, we can do all the efforts in terms of supply reduction. We will never reach the result.
That was the delegate from Uruguay addressing the Commission on Narcotic Drugs meeting in late September. For now, that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host and producer, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.